today on Annenberg Radio News.
But you have people who make it their own and put some type of jujitsu into it or dance. And that's what I typically do the whole time is I just listen to my music, dance.
We'll tell you about the technique of sign spinning. It's more complicated than you think. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California for December 5th, 2013. This is Annenberg Radio News. I'm Ryan Buzion. Madiba is gone. Nelson Mandela died today at the age of 95 at his home in Johannesburg, South Africa. The Nobel Prize winner was revered the world over for his actions. He was a key contributor to the creation of South Africa's democratic, multiracial government in 1994. He guided the country as its first black president thereafter. South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, announced Mandela's death today at a press conference, saying, quote, "We lost our greatest son," unquote. President Obama also spoke about the loss.
"We will not likely see the likes of Nelson Mandela again. So it falls to us, as best we can, to follow the example that he set, to make decisions guided not by hate, but by love, to never discount the difference that one person can make, to strive for a future that is worthy of his sacrifice."
Nelson Mandela is survived by his wife and his three daughters. Here in Los Angeles, we've had another loss. We learned today that L.A. school board member Marguerite Poindexter Lamott has died. Lamott was known as a strong supporter of teachers and as an advocate for arts education. No details about her death have yet been released, but the Daily News reports that she died in San Diego while attending a convention. City Councilman Bernard Park says Lamott's first priority was always the students.
"She was an advocate of ensuring that young students got an opportunity for advancement beyond college. I think she had a kind of a general outlook in the sense of improving the entire system for the betterment, particularly of minority students."
Lamott worked as a principal at Washington Prep High School. She served on the school board for over 10 years. Lamott was 80 years old. Fast food workers across the nation are starting to give the orders rather than take them. Today marked the start of major protests at big fast food chains such as Taco Bell, KFC, and Burger King. Law Murray was in the middle of a crowd at McDonald's earlier today as it all went down.
Fast food workers nationwide have had enough of low wages while working for lucrative global corporations. And here at this McDonald's on Sunset and Fountain in LA, the issue has reached a boiling point.
Keep your burgers, keep your fries!
Organizers say that fast food workers earn a median wage of about $9 an hour. In LA, that kind of pay doesn't even cover basic expenses. Many fast food employees have to rely on public assistance to make ends meet. Bartolome Perez has worked at McDonald's for 20 years and makes just over $10 an hour.
"You have to pay more of $1,000 of rent, pay for your food, buy a good kind of food, and live with four people in your family."
He and these workers want $15 an hour, as well as the right to form a union without the threat of losing their jobs. The National Restaurant Association said that a dramatic salary increase would hurt job growth and raise prices. Sarah Newell from the Student Coalition Against Labor Exploitation says she would be willing to pay higher prices for fast food.
"Personally, if that's what it took, I would do it, but if that's not what it takes, the corporation is making the profits. McDonald's made $5.5 billion in pure profit this year alone, so they can use those profits to pay their workers a living wage."
President Obama weighed in on the strike, saying that it was past time to raise the minimum wage. Law Murray, Annenberg Radio News.
Today's protests made us wonder if higher wages for fast food workers might mean the end of the dollar menu as we know it. So we asked our own Logan Healy to look into it.
Striking fast food workers today demanded a $15 an hour minimum wage. But labor experts say these protests are not a simple call for higher pay.
I think the best way to think of it is holistically as an effort to significantly upgrade the quality of jobs in this industry so that the millions of people who are currently working in retail sectors can, in fact, enjoy a middle-class way of life.
That's Robert Bruno. He specializes in labor and employment at the University of Illinois. He says a spike in wages might cause a modest price increase for fast food consumers, but better pay would also increase worker productivity and customer service. Opponents of a higher minimum wage say it will make employers likely to fire workers or reluctant to hire more. But Chris Tilley, a labor and unemployment professor at UCLA, says that's not the case.
There's really no evidence that increasing minimum wages is a job killer.
He says corporations could help owners of franchises by lowering their fees. Bruno says that idea brings up a bigger question.
It also raises the question, you know, what is a suitable profit margin?
He says moving retail workers into the middle class not only creates more customers for business, but these better paid workers would also generate more tax revenue. Jot Condi, CEO of the California Restaurant Association, said in a statement that restaurants usually operate on a profit margin between 1 and 5%. He also said today's protesters are more likely to be labor activists and paid demonstrators rather than actual fast food workers. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
Pakistani community members and anti-war organizations are gathered in Westwood at this hour to protest U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. Our reporter Danielle Tarasuk is in Westwood right now and joins us live. Danielle, can you describe the scene down there?
Yes, I'm standing right here in front of the federal building, and there are about 20 protesters holding signs asking that the U.S. stop drone strikes in Pakistan.
Can you explain the significance of this protest in regards to the other protests taking place in the Middle East?
Sure. This protest is actually part of a series of protests happening all over the world. There was one last week in front of the UN. The protest was actually put together by a political group in Pakistan named Pakistan Tahrir Insaf. And they are actually holding off NATO delivering medical equipment and a food to Afghanistan through Pakistan until the drone strikes end.
All right. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Thank you.
Protesters are demanding that the U.S. stop their drone strikes along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Former LAPD Chief William Bratton was named NYPD Commissioner today. This will be Bratton's second stint as New York's top police. Bratton was also chief of the Boston Police Department. Some 3,600 L.A. County social workers demonstrated downtown today. They are on strike, demanding higher pay and lower caseloads. This is their first walkout in nearly a decade, as Jacob Ellenhorn reports.
The Service Employees International Union, which represents 55,000 employees in Los Angeles County, nearly reached a settlement with the Department of Children and Family Services, but talks at an impasse over pay raises.
It just seems like the county has not been bargaining in good faith. We were at the table, we're bargaining, but then when it came down to caseload, they didn't want to talk to anyone, and then they pulled everything off the table, which is unfair. So right now, what we're asking for is to reduce our caseload.
The SEIU Union, Local 721, has also asked Family Services to hire an additional 595 new workers to handle the burgeoning caseload. Los Angeles social workers handle an average of 38 cases. The union demanded additional hires to bring the average caseload down to 30 cases per worker. One of the strikers was Jasmine Chavara. She said that studies show that child safety suffers when social workers' caseload goes above 14.
It has been proven that the recommended ratio is 14 to 16 children per worker. Currently, social workers are working at double that. In ER, first responders, we're working at 27 to 33 children per worker.
While the strike is currently isolated to county social workers, it may spread as the SEIU calls upon its other members to respect the picket line. Jacob Ellenhorn, Annenberg Radio News.
We're in for a cold weekend, LA. Temperatures plummeted to 4 degrees in Ventura last night, and parts of the San Fernando Valley fell below freezing. Don't expect a thaw this weekend, as forecasters are predicting overnight frost for the Los Angeles Basin. The winter chill will pass next week as a Canadian air mass moves east. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we hear about a big milestone for a Latin pop star. Fermented foods are tasty, healthy, and literally rotten. Fermenting foods is an ancient cooking tradition that preserves and adds flavor to different foods. Grace Lim visited Granny Cho's Kimchi Company to see how they are using this classic cooking technique.
Kimchi is one of those pungent foods that's best if you've grown up eating it. The spicy side dish made of Napa cabbage, garlic, onions, and red peppers is a staple of the Korean diet, except for Connie Cho Harkles.
I actually didn't grow up eating kimchi, which is kind of bad. Like, oh, I'm a bad Korean. Like, I don't speak Korean. I don't really have a lot of Korean friends because there just aren't that many Korean people out here.
Choi Harkle grew up in the predominantly white suburb of Moorpark, California, about 50 miles northwest of Los Angeles. Since then, she's married her non-Korean childhood sweetheart and didn't have much contact with Korean culture. Then 5 years ago, Choi Harkle quit her job in marketing and had a baby and was looking for a project to take on.
My mom thought, oh, this is the perfect time, because, and she came up with the idea, like, hey, let's sell kimchi to, you know, non-Korean people, since people seem like they're getting more interested in fermentation and food preservation and probiotic foods.
So Choi Harkle teamed up with her mother, Ogi Cho, and started to fine-tune their own kimchi recipe to sell online and in local Whole Foods markets. And even though Choi Harkle didn't grow up eating kimchi as a child, she's been elbow deep in the stuff many times since.
When we first started the business, like, you know, I would smell a jar of kimchi. I'm like, I don't know, it smells like garlic. And my mom would be like, oh yeah, this batch is no good. Oh, this one's still fresh. This one needs some time. And I'm like, my nose didn't know the difference. And now at this point, like, I know, like, oh yeah, this is gonna be a good batch. Give it another week, it'll be better.
So what does a good ripe batch of kimchi smell like?
I don't know, there are like a lot of different notes in it. So you can smell that it's garlicky and oniony and spicy, but then there's sort of that other layer behind it. That's the fermented layer. It's very distinct and it smells like fermented vegetables. But if you haven't smelled fermented vegetables, you might think it smells like socks or, you know, it's like stinky cheeses. Like if you don't know what it is, it's like, oh, is something rotting? But if you know what it is, then it smells good.
But like Choi Harkle said, she had to learn what smelled good from her mom, who immigrated from Korea 40 years ago. Choi and her daughter make and package the kimchi in a commercial kitchen with two Mexican workers. But Choi remembers what it was like to make kimchi and eat it as a young girl in her community in Korea.
In about November, when the winter starts, every household would buy tons of caps. Napa cabbage, and the neighbors gather together and make a kimchi one house, and then next house, and we sprinkle the salt and put it in the big, gigantic ceramic jar, and we dig the ground, and then we would take it out one by one to eat it all winter long.
Choi doesn't bury 5-foot-high clay jars of kimchi in her yard anymore, thanks to 21st century technology. But Choi Harkle is pleased that cooking kimchi with her mom and her 5-year-old daughter has connected her more with Korean culture.
I know kimchi, I know it really well now. You know, I know it in and out. I've been covered in kimchi after being in the kitchen. Like, I'm very familiar with it now. So it is kind of nice to have that tie.
Kimchi has connected the Choi family through the generations and to their home culture in Korea. And as Korean food gains popularity in America, stinky kimchi may become as common as stinky cheese. Grace Lim, Annenberg Radio News.
Again, I'm saddened to say that Nelson Mandela has died at the age of 95. Mandela became one of the world's most beloved statesmen and an international symbol for peace and equality. Mandela was a leader in the anti-apartheid movement against white rule in South Africa. In 1964, he was convicted of treason and sentenced to life in prison. As knowledge of apartheid spread, Mandela became the world's most famous political prisoner. He spent 27 years in the Robben Island prison, enduring harsh conditions in solitary confinement. As opposition to apartheid grew, he was released from prison in 1990. When he emerged, he negotiated an end to white minority rule in South Africa, and 3 years after his prison sentence, he became the country's first black president. USC journalism professor Ernest Smith takes students to study in South Africa every summer.
I think it means the world has one less angel. Mostly what it should mean for the world is that, you know, one man's life can make it a tremendous difference, can change the world. This was a man who was able to live his life with a consistent sense of quiet dignity, strength, and perseverance. To me, the amazing thing about this life, of all the many things this man has accomplished and what he has meant to the world, he was able, in the end, to die on his own terms, at home, with dignity and peace.
We sent our own Stephanie Monti out to talk to USC students about Mandela and his legacy.
Courtney Rye, I was a second-year grad student. I studied in South Africa for a month. There's still a lot happening there as far as race relations, but what everyone comes together on is their love and respect for him, and I think that says it all.
My name is Keith Vignette. I'm an economics major, and I'm a junior. It's definitely a momentous occasion. Like, it was a great life. You know, he was a great figure in not only South African politics, but also just left-wing politics as a whole. Like, he was an arbiter of racial equality. You know, he made great strides in, like, promoting the equality of the human race.
Ashley Nash. I think he has a tenacity that's really admirable. He doesn't really give up easily.
Constance Elo. I'm a PhD candidate in the Rosser School of Education. It's just really hard to process, but I think it's really a time to reflect on a number of his contributions, the spirit of activism that he ignited in a lot of people across the world.
Los Angeles Congresswoman Karen Bass was among those reacting to Mandela's death.
Being in prison for 27 years, fighting against an extremely repressive regime, leaving prison and a few months later becoming president of the country, that is truly an inspiration for the world.
A film based on Mandela's life is in theaters now. It is called Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. Today, Ford unveiled the new 2015 Mustang in honor of the car's 50th anniversary.
My name is Jim Foster. I'm a member of five different Mustang clubs and also a member of the Fabulous Ford Council that puts on the Knott's Berry Farm show. I'm a Mustang owner myself. I've owned my car for 37 and a half years. It's my first car and I still have it.
So what brings you here today? What's happening right here?
Because of my interest in Mustangs and so forth over the past couple of years, Ford themselves invited me to come and be a participant on this historical event of seeing the unveiling of the 2015 Mustang. And I was greatly appreciative of that and was able to attend.
And what makes this one more special?
It's like the 50-year anniversary of the Mustang in general, too. It's kind of like a commemoration towards 50 years of great cars.
What is it about the Mustang?
The history behind it, the way it handles, the way it performs, just the overall love for it, really. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people have the same feeling, too. They just love the way it handles and the way it performs.
Has it always been a good car?
Mine has, yes, but in general, yes, it has.
What is your car?
Mine's a 1968 coupe Mustang.
And you still love it?
I still love it. Still got it, and it's even here today, too, as a matter of fact.
How did you feel when you first saw yours?
Well, my dad was the one that actually drove it to me because I was needing a car at the time, and it looked pretty cool. And he says, well, I'm looking to get a car for you. So I go, do you like it? And they go, yeah, I like it. It'll be great to have. So, and ever since then, I've enjoyed it.
You just grew to love it.
Yes, it grows into you, very much so, yes.
How does it feel when you drive it?
Exhilarating, a lot of fun, power when you need it, and a lot of people when they see me driving by, they give me the thumbs up saying they like the way it looks and all that stuff as well too.
Yeah.
And just as an extra side note, a little over 2 years ago, Katy Perry used this car in her music video, The One That Got Away. She actually drove the car.
Wow. Favorite years of cars? Because they look different through the years. Like they're
I like the early 60s from like 64 and a half to 69. Are my favorite years. In the 70s looked nice too. After that, it just didn't really, in my opinion, have quite the Mustang look feel to it. until the 2000 series came out, like 2006, I believe it was. And then they started to look more retro again.
Do you think it's harkening back to the roots of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it will.
What about the new one down there? I haven't looked at that yet. I'd love to see it just for my own reason.
It looks really nice. And I actually was able to sit in it and get a picture of myself in the car, too. Mm-hmm. One of the few people I was able to. But it looks really nice. Looks really sharp. I think it's going to be a big hit.
Matthew Tinoco and Victor Figueroa prepared that report. Latin pop star Thalia was recognized today with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Many Mexican-Americans are seeing this as a major milestone. Reporter Matthew Tinoco has more.
Thalia, the queen of Latin pop and a supernovella star, nabbed the 2,514th star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame today. Fans shared her excitement. Fans like Vanessa Fuentes are elated.
She deserves it like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yes.
Thalia is a Mexican-born actress and singer and is widely considered to be the most successful female Latin pop star. Her songs have climbed the top 10 of the Latin Billboard song chart 28 times. In addition to her music, the telenovela icon has 2 billion soap opera fans around the globe. Fuentes says that Thalia's star is historical.
She's making history with all these people here. I've heard that other Hispanic celebrities haven't gathered as much people as Thalia. I'm sure even like Anglo celebrities haven't had this many people. So it's a great example to show that we rock.
Matthew Tinoco, Annenberg Radio News.
There is a new underground extreme sport taking off across the world. It's now on every continent and has a world championship. It is a subculture of guerrilla advertising and the technique of sign spinning. Brianna Sox went and explored.
You would never guess how much goes on behind a spinning sign.
My name's Keith. I am 27 years old, and I am a sign spinner.
Standing in the hot mid-afternoon sun in his bright red uniform,
I've been doing it ever
Keith
since
has
while
been flipping his sign for about 4 hours now, smiling and sweating away.
It's definitely a sport. There's competitions once a year. You see all these different cool personalities between the spinners and their techniques. Like, I'm more of a technical person, but you have people who make it their own and put some type of jujitsu into it or dance.
Not only is sign spinning a subculture, it's also a competitive professional sport, and it's gone international. I tracked down Mike Kenny, one of the founders, to learn about the world of sign spinning.
We got started spinning signs back when we were 18 years old. We had a job holding a sign on the street corner, and it was just one of the most boring jobs on the planet. We started spinning the sign around just to get people's attention and to make sure we had a better time. And we started noticing that there was more and more people going into our clients' locations. Now we've expanded to 30 different US cities and 9 countries. Somehow we've actually gotten to be on every continent. We have spinners in South Africa competing against our spinners in Australia versus South Korea.
Every year, hundreds of sign spinners go head-to-head at the Sign Spinning World Championship in Las Vegas. Because, yes, there is such a thing, and it's a big deal.
We're like the NBA or the NFL. We're the professional sign spinning league.
Just like any other sport, these guys start at the bottom. They make $8 an hour, go to weekly practices, meet with coaches, until they can do something like this.
It's called a scissor catch, which means that you either throw the sign up in the air or kick the sign up in the air in some manner, and then you basically do a handstand, catch the sign between your legs, and then land it perfectly.
Mike introduced me to LA's spinstructors, one of their spinonyms, Eric Argote and Christian Altamirano.
Actually, I train everyone. I train.
Christian has been to 3 world championships.
It's an experience. Really huge competition, you know, like just like another football game. Just got a bunch of people around you and you got competitors and just like a lot of intensity. Like, whoa, that was tight.
Still questioning how intense this sport really is, I tagged along to one of the weekly practices at a park in North Hollywood. I pulled up to see Mike and Christian fumbling across the grass, carrying about 20 large 4-pound signs bearing the names of companies like Jiffy Lube, Subway, and El Pollo Loco. As practice gets underway, I glance around the busy park. No one notices a group of people circled up smack in the middle of the lawn, chucking signs into the air.
But everybody in
the
practice,
behind the backspins, you want to leverage the weight against your...
Pull them back, push side, forward make sure with it's your balanced. Palms.
Founder Mike Kenny says sign spinning is a great example of how we often miss things flashing, or in this case spinning, right in front of us. This is how these guys get so good at spinning a sign.
And you have something to trace the foot with.
This is their warm-up stretching period for the intensity that is about to ensue. All right, I'm going to go see how hard this really is to flip a sign above my head.
Do I bend my knees?
Not dropping it.
I kind of think I like this. Yeah. I don't know. There's something more stable about it for some reason. Oh, wait. I did it wrong. It's a lot of concentration. Almost half.
Try and get it more up.
Up? Yeah. Not back. Almost half.
I kept confusing where my hands were supposed to go, dodging the sign once I realized it might hit me in the face, and just watching it kerplunk over and over.
Challenging.
Michael Erickson, who has been spinning for 7 years, says it takes vigilance to become a master of the sign.
Well, you gotta always be training. They teach you new tricks every practice. So I like to take those tricks and like go to the corner and get them really down to the like my own tricks.
Mike Kenny says many people think spinning a sign on a street corner is simple, just someone doing their average job. But that's because most don't look closely enough.
There's a subculture to this. They see that it's, oh, some guy on the corner got good spinning a sign. It's been going on since the medieval times, you know, with people wearing the sandwich boards. So the concept's been there forever, but we've been the only ones to take it and turn it into something more than that. And one day it'll be in the Olympics or in the X Games. You know, there has to be a little bit of that dreamer mentality for it to even come true.
So next time, if you see someone spinning a sign outside a store, stop. You might just be watching a world champion in action.
Oh, one handy.
Brianna Sachs, Annenberg Radio News.
Yeah, you guys are the best.
All right, now we're going to check in with the lovely Rachel Scott to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Rachel?
Thanks, Ryan. A former L.A. top cop is making a new move to New York as the city's new police commissioner. And with violence escalating in Central African Republic, see what the United Nations has done to intervene. A 7-year-old boy was gunned down in the mid-city L.A. Find out what social media campaign against violence is being launched by Hollywood's top stars. Those stories and more coming up tonight on Annenberg TV News at 6.
Okay, my friends, that's it for this Thursday and for this semester. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I want to take a second to thank everyone that's a part of our Thursday crew. Allison Brett, Julian De Ocampo, Jacob Ellenhorn, Denise Guerra, Logan Healy, Grace Lim, Lawrence Murray, Stephanie Monti, Selena Sayer Reynolds, Danielle Tarasuk, Balu Tiansi, Matthew Tinoco, Ashley Wong, and Victor Figueroa has been holding down the boards for me all year. Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, and the newscast producer is the one and only Jerome Campbell. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis, and Joel Zink is our technical guru for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News. I'm Ryan Bouzion. Stay classy, LA, and have a wonderful holiday season. We will see you in January.